Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
Well, either this morning's message is sponsored and brought to you by Diet Coke, or that has something to do with God's Word that we're going to find out in the next 30 minutes. If you know me well enough, I think you know which one it is. That was actually a very unsuccessful campaign for Diet Coke. They pulled the ad shortly after it went out. And the reason why is, although marketers, advertisers, they spend a lot of time researching humanity. They spend a lot of time researching people, because they want their ads to reflect the people, connect with the people they're trying to reach out to. And on the one hand, that ad did a wonderful job of sort of reflecting the current generation. The problem is, we don't necessarily like what we look like, if you will, when we see a portrait of it. Like, when you saw that, did any of you think, yeah, that's the kind of person I want to be, right? Yeah. That's me right there. No, sometimes when you see yourself as you really are, you're almost repulsed by it. And the reason for that is because, of course, we talk about every generation looks at another generation and calls them selfish, right? The baby boomer generation was called the, anybody know? The me generation. That's what you were called by your parents. They called you the me generation. And then you looked at the generation that came after you, my generation, and you said, well, you're the me now generation. You're not just about you. You're about you, and you got to have it right now. And so it's almost like, you know, we may have been selfish, but you're selfish and demanding. And then the current generation, some either call it the me generation, or more appropriately now, they're calling it the selfie generation. It's pretty much all about me and what I look like, and I'm going to put that out there for everybody else. It's estimated right now that 1,000 selfies are posted to Instagram every 10 seconds. So already, what, 3,000, 4,000 Instagrams have already gone out just in the time I've opened up this message. It's estimated that the average selfie generation person, well, the millennial generation, will post 25,000 pictures of themselves on social media before they die. That's about the rate that we're going. And if you're self-conscious about the way you look, no problem. There's an app for that, right? You can cream cam it, you can gloss it, you can do everything. You can put mouse ears on it if you think that's going to improve the way you look. I don't know. You can do anything you want to do, but put it out there. And so Diet Coke was targeting this generation, this culture of the selfie generation. If you want to yurt it up, do whatever you want to do. I'm going to drink a Coke just simply because I feel like it. And the problem is, there's another principle at work that Diet Coke did not realize. And that is that although we all struggle with selfishness, there's a thing there where pride repulses people, selfishness repulses people, and humility acts like a magnet. And so as you watch that, although it may have been a reflection of us, it was sort of repulsive. And you're kind of like, ew, I don't want to hang out with that girl. She's just so self-absorbed. She's just doing whatever she wants to do. Her excuse for drinking a Coke is simply because she feels like it. Now, in watching that, I had to feel a little bit of a conviction. I mentioned 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago when I started this series about Love Works that the whole idea that we don't do anything, we don't use the rationale, if I don't feel like it, I'm not going to do it. We don't use that rationale. It doesn't work for whether or not we're going to obey the laws or other things. And I got to stand corrected by what I saw in the Coke ad, and pretty much their whole premise is do whatever you feel like. I got to thinking about it. Maybe I was wrong in what I said. Maybe that really is sort of a guiding ethos in life. We only do what it is we feel like doing. And that's pretty much what we've cultivated in this generation is do what you feel like. And if you don't feel like it, then by all means, go somewhere else. Look for somebody else. Look for someone else. And so that gets back to this whole series. It's about love works. Love works if you do. Love's going to take work. As Barry White said, love don't come easy. Or love ain't easy. Anytime you quote Barry White, it's just a good morning, right? I mean, it's just, wish I could do it with his voice, right? So loving ain't easy, and it's impossible without humility. It's absolutely impossible without humility. Oftentimes, you may be working and trying to do all the work of love, but if you're doing it without a disposition of humility, it's absolutely impossible. And the thing about humility is, nowhere in the scriptures will you see God ever say, be humble. It's sort of like saying, be exercise. Yeah, I am exercise. That's who I am. That's how I feel. No, you can't feel exercise. You can't be exercise. You have to do exercise. You can't just feel humble. You can't say, I just am humble. I'm going to be humble. No, you actually have to do humility. You can't just be it. You have to do it. And so all the exhortations about humility is about doing that which is humble, not being it. In the same sense that you can't just be exercise. And so I'm about to get to the scriptures here eventually. There's just so much good setup stuff on this. One of the marriage books I was reading talked about how the number one problem in marriage and relationships in general is, of course, self-centeredness. And I was thinking about my own marriage, and that's true. The biggest problem in my marriage is Rebecca is self-centered. I mean, that's pretty much, and she's out of town, so I can say that. That was a joke. You can delete that text right now if you know her number. It was a joke, flat out. No, we all have a problem with self-centeredness, and I am a major contributor, chief contributor in my own marriage to that thing. And in some sense, it's an evolutionary piece of us, if you will, if you go into evolution. I don't like the whole evolution, but I'll go to the theological side of it. People ask, are we born guilty of sin? Well, I can say this. We are born sinful in the sense that the root of all sinfulness is selfishness, and we are born selfish. Can anybody deny that? I mean, how many of y'all have children who came into this world caring about your needs? It just doesn't happen. The role of parenting is nothing more than basically disciplining the selfish desires and selfish tendencies out of a child to the point where they're mildly sort of sociable within today's realm, right? I mean, it's never going to completely get out. But you certainly look at some kids that you don't want in your house, and the reason why you don't want them in, their house is because they're selfish. The reason why you'd be scared to death of your child marrying that kid is because they're so selfish. And the degree to which you can remove and discipline the selfishness out of them so they're mildly acceptable in humanity or with society is really the role of parenting, which gets us to Philippians chapter 2. Now, Bob Lapine, have you ever listened to, anybody ever listened to Family Life Today? So it's, nobody in here has ever heard of Family Life Today. Wow, okay, a few. It's Christian radio. Basically, they have like a 30-minute special that just every day on the radio, I used to work in Christian radio, and it was just basically they would have different people on talking about your family issues and how to, you know, have a better, happier family, a better marriage, better parenting. And he says in there that the best verse for marriage, he says 90% of all marital problems would be fixed if you would just memorize and apply this one passage in your marriage. 90%, he says, from my experience, 90% of your marriage problems would be fixed if you would just memorize and apply this passage out of Philippians. That's what we're going to be looking at this morning. And of course, it addresses what the other author says is the number one problem in marriage, and that is issue of humility. So if you look over in Philippians chapter 2, beginning of verse 1, he says, therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if you have any comfort in his love, any common sharing in the Spirit, any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete, being like-minded, having the same love, being in one spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you looking to the interests of others. I kind of developed my own paraphrase of this passage, and I'm going to read the paraphrase, which is sort of a way to explain what it is I just read to you. Is that all right? He says, if you've been lifted up, in other words, if you've been carried by or benefited from what Jesus has done for you, just think about all that Christ has done for you, what he did for you on the cross. If you've been in any way benefited from that, been lifted up by that, encouraged by that, if you found comfort from his love, if the Spirit of God is in you, if you've experienced the tenderness and compassion of God towards you, in that even though you were a sinner, undeserving of grace, Jesus decided to humble himself and took your sin upon him and carried it up to the cross. If you've experienced all that, benefited from all of that, and have the Spirit of God in you because of all of that, he says, if that's going to elicit any kind of response from you, if you're going to take that and sort of take that in, and that really hits you to your core, it should elicit a certain response. You should have a certain reaction to this. And it should be to show the same kind of love and the spirit of unity that understands that we're all in this together. And I would really love to see that in you because it would let me know that you really understand the gospel. So Paul's writing this to a church that he had ministered to, a church that he had shared the gospel with, and he's saying, listen, you would make my joy complete. In other words, I would really know that you get it. See, it's one thing, sometimes I get criticized because I rarely encourage you to just pray a prayer for salvation. And because I have a hard time, I don't want you to be led to believe that simply because you prayed a mindless prayer that that somehow means you have a loving relationship with God that you'll enjoy for all eternity. Do you hear my heart on that? It's not that I have a problem with you praying a prayer. It's not that I have a problem with you praying a prayer of confession. It's just I've always been uncomfortable when a pastor would say, pray this after me. Okay, now you're a Christian. You'll be saved. You go to heaven. I have a hard time with that because if you just pray that prayer and don't genuinely have a loving relationship with God, but you sort of just did it to kind of get your get-out-of-jail-free card, I've been very misleading. I've been more misleading than anybody should ever be. That was pretty much the worst bait-and-switch sales tactic ever. And so I have a hard time doing that because I just stress every week. You need to have a loving relationship with God. Well, what does that entail? That's... You kind of have to work that out. You have to sort of think about what does it mean to have a loving relationship. It's not just a check the box off any more than you simply say, well, I'm married because I said I do. I hope there's something more than just that to your marriage, right? So back to this. So he's saying, Paul's saying, listen, I was there and I share with you the gospel, but you know, you don't really know if somebody really has a relationship with God until you see the fruit in their life, until you see what it really produces. You don't know what a tree is. I've told you this about trees in Florida. You don't know what the tree is if you move there at the wrong time of year. You don't know if you're stuck with a lousy mango tree or if you got one of the awesome orange trees. Now, don't send me any more mangoes or tell me about how much you love mangoes. I don't care. Nobody in Florida wants them. So, or a lemon tree. Great, got lemons. Everybody wants a tangerine or an orange tree or a honeybell. That's what you want. And so you don't really know what you have until you see it come out. He says, so make my joy complete. Let me really know that all the stuff that you said you experienced with Christ is really there, and I'll know in the way that you treat one another. Jesus said something similar. Everybody will know you're one of my disciples if you, anybody? Love one another. If you love one another as I've loved you, then I'll know, everybody will know that you're one of my disciples. And so Paul's saying, listen, make my joy complete. Let me know that you really get it. And I will know that you really get it, not by just what you say, but I'll know by what you do. And what I want to see happen in your life, what I want to see you do is, and this is where he comes out with a sense of humility. He says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. So I went back and looked at some of the Greek behind this, and I thought it was kind of interesting, the richness in here. The Greek word means to act for one's own gain, which you might say, well, I could have figured that out by selfish ambition. But the key is, regardless of the conflict that it would cause. It's I'm going to look out for my own interest regardless of whatever kind of conflict might arise from me looking out for myself. In other words, if I have to step on you to get what I want, so be it, tough for you. That's sort of the attitude that's brought out in this word. This is why James uses the same word over in James chapter 3, verse 16. He says, wherever you have this envy and selfish ambition, same word, you'll find disorder in every evil practice. In other words, obviously there's going to be conflict if this is your attitude. If you go into life and go through life, worse yet, if you go into marriage with the idea that I'm going to be looking out for myself, even if that hurts you, even if it's at your own expense, it doesn't take a genius or a psychologist or a relational therapist to figure out you're going to have conflict in every relationship you enter. And then he goes on, he says, selfish ambition or vain conceit. And that is, now listen, remember, messages are for you, not for the person next to you. Restrain your elbows, control your nervous twitch. Vain conceit, the Greek word, says it is demonstrated when we reject the attitude that we are always right. It describes somebody who is excessively proud of their own opinion. And you can see how this would make conversation very difficult, especially if you put these lethal two together. Somebody who only cares about themselves at the expense of everybody else and assumes they're right in what they're doing. Now, I'm not going to ask if you're married to that person or if you've experienced that person because the reality is we're all selfish, right? We all struggle with selfish ambition and vain conceit. We all have this issue of seeing ourselves as right. We all have an issue of looking to our own interests, to the neglect of everybody else's. All of us have this problem. And the reason why you recognize this in everybody else is because in your effort to get the last piece of pie, you know who got the last piece of pie. And you're still bent about it. And you still have 100 reasons why it was yours. Because you feel it was yours just as much as they felt it was theirs. The only difference is they got to it first and they beat you with their self-ambition. And you're just bent over the fact that you got beat to it, not over the fact that they didn't show humility. That's the reality. That's a summary of our marital arguments, or at least the ones I have. Rather, in your marital conflict, you've got to get to the point where you move to a different attitude in these conversations. And if you think about your marital conflict, you've walked into it with that sort of idea in your mind, whether you'll admit it or not. Rather, he says, you need to be going into it saying, I'm going to focus on you. I'm going to give you my full attention. I want to listen until you know that you've been listened to. I want to listen until I know that you've been that I fully understand what it is that you're saying. I'm going to ask clarifying questions. Even if, and here's the problem, in the back of your mind, you want to cut all that out because I already know the answer. I already know the solution. I already know what you're going to say. Let's just cut to the chase. We don't need to have time for this. Your mind's thinking all that because you're incredibly intelligent. And in your vain conceit, you assume you already know what is right. So why do I need to listen to you? No. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, just listen. And listen until they know that they've been listened to. Until they know that you understand what they're saying. Seek to understand before that you seek to be understood in that conflict. Pray that God would change you, not them. As you go into this, say, God, what needs to change in me for us to resolve this conflict? How do I need to see this differently? What do I need to do differently? Rarely have I ever had anybody come in for counseling and say, Pastor Stevens, you need to sit down. I'm the problem in my marriage. Here's everything out. Tell me what God can do to move me in a better direction. Never. It's usually, here's what they're doing, and I'm sure I contribute something. But let's talk about them, right? That's because of selfish ambition and vain conceit. Rather, if you're going into it, remember, he cloaks all of this in remembering the gospel. Remember what the gospel says about you. What the gospel says about you is that you are unworthy of love. There's nothing in me. I haven't done anything to deserve God's love. I didn't earn it. I didn't deserve it. It wasn't because I was so holy or righteous or special that God chose to set his love upon me. He just did. The gospel says I'm unworthy of love, and God has chosen to give me his love. And you see, when I enter into a marriage, I have this idea that I deserve her love. I deserve to be loved. I've earned it. And you need to therefore show it to me. And I come in with an attitude of expectation. Whereas he says, if you go into it with the understanding in the same way that you have the gospel, it'll change the way you see your relationship. That any love they give me is completely undeserved. Any respect they show me is completely undeserved. They're doing it simply because they've chosen to set their love upon me, because they've given me. I have to realize that my life is basically immersed in swimming in grace. I mean, think about it. If your partner really knew everything about you, I mean, they knew everything. You say you've disclosed everything, but you haven't. If you really disclosed everything, anybody in here worried they might leave? You are swimming in grace. You are swimming in grace. Don't make God have to humble you to get you to the point where you realize how much you're swimming in grace. It's so much more convenient, so much more beautiful, so much more wonderful in life to humble yourself instead of having to be humbled. And so he's saying if you've gotten anything out of the gospel, you should have gotten out of it that God has just chosen to set his love upon you, that your life is immersed in grace, and you should go into your conflict simply realizing, I wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for grace. And everything here is all temporary anyway. And what difference does it make if I get my way or don't get my way? This is all short-lived. This is, I've said this before, this is all preschool. Everything we argue about here and now is all preschool. You look at the stuff that your kids argue about when they're in preschool, and there's a piece of you which just says, who cares who gets the My Little Pony? Who cares? I don't care if you have Rarity or if you play with Pinkie Pie. It doesn't matter. Okay, just letting you in on my little world here of what you're going with My Little Pony. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you got to play with Aquaman or The Flash today. It doesn't matter. When you're 30, you won't even care. Hopefully. Just, right? And yet we assume that our marital conflict is of internal significance. But in light of eternity, it's just not as big of a deal as you make it out to be. It doesn't matter if it was Paul on Tuesday or if it was Fred on Thursday. Why do you have to correct? Just let it go. He says, rather, in humility, value others above yourselves. Notice he says, some of your translations may say value, some may say consider, some may say count. Value is what you've chosen to make the value, right? I mean, how much is something worth? Anybody know? How much is something worth? What is it? What you're willing to pay for it, right? Value is determined by what somebody is willing to pay for it. There is no intrinsic value. It's just what somebody is willing to pay for it. Now, somebody may be willing to pay $200 for a special pair of Nikes, but let famine strike a land, okay, and nobody's paying more than 5 cents for a nice pair of shoes, right? Rather, you're going to pay $200 for a loaf of bread, right? Value is what you're willing to pay for. Value is in the eye of the beholder. And so what he's saying here is this is a choice that you're making, what you will value, what you will count them as, what you will consider them as, and you should consider them, you should value them above yourself. You should value and consider them above yourself. And some of you might be thinking, well, if I do that, if I go into the relationship this way, then who's going to be looking out for me? They might be taking advantage of me. And to which Jesus would say, you know, I was always worried about that too. You know, what hurt the most in the garden is when after I'd washed Judas's feet, man, he went and did that. Didn't see that one coming. No, remember, he washes Judas's feet. It was an act of humility, and yet he knows. As soon as he's done with that, he gets up and he says, one of you is going to betray me. He knew. He knew the whole time. He knew when he forgave you. He knew when he forgave the disciples. He looks at Peter and says, you're going to deny me three times. He knew when he forgave you that you would take advantage of his grace. And so, yes, it's going to leave you open to be taken advantage of. But if you're going to love like Christ loves, so be it. Wouldn't that be an awesome complaint to walk into heaven? Well, God, I don't know, man. I guess just love like you did, and everybody took advantage of me, man. It's like, yeah, you must have been last everywhere you went because of that too, huh? Yeah. Some verse is coming to mind. I don't know if you remember it too. What do you say about the last? Yeah, last will become first. The servant is greatest of all. So how does this play out in your relationship? I keep going all week long and studying this. I kept going back to old book. Anybody ever read His Needs, Her Needs? It's one of the old classic books for marriage. If you're struggling in your relationship, it's one of those great marriage books to have read. It's kind of like everybody should have on their list things like the five love languages. You should have on your list His Needs, Her Needs. It was done by a psychiatrist or a family counselor who kept having issues of marital problems, and people kept going outside of the marriage, look for their needs to get met. And so he pretty much was, after doing all this study and research, he realized, he says, there's pretty much five fundamental things that husbands are looking for in a marriage and five fundamental things that wives are looking for in the marriage, and they're completely different. And the problem is we spend the whole time in marriage demanding our needs get met and thinking that we're meeting our spouse's needs simply because we're addressing our needs. And if our relationship had all five of these things, and I'm going to do these five things for you and you do these five things for me, we're going to be great. And the other person is saying, yeah, I agree. Do these five things for me and I'll do these five things for you and it'll all be great. The problem is they're both trying to do five different things. In the same way that in the love languages issue, people are trying to love each other through different languages and different styles. One's loving through words and one wants some, you know, quality time. That there's a disconnect. Well, same issues here with His Needs, Her Needs. Five biggest things on women's list. Now listen, this is women in general. You may not have these as your top five things. That's okay. There may be some of them. A great discussion on your way home is, those are my five, those aren't my five. I would replace number four with this one right here. And then if you really want to go through the gauntlet, ask the question, honey, what are your five needs? How have I been doing at meeting them? You want to have a test of your humility? Ask the question. If you want to have a test of your humility, have the question asked to you and answer with the same humility. I don't know which is harder. So he says his top five needs for women. Number one is affection. This is a gentle touch. This is everything that usually gets done around Valentine's Day. This is what women want all year long. They want a note. They want a card. They want flowers. They want something from you that lets them know that you love them, care about them, think about them. They want to know that they're cherished. They want to know that they're valued. They want to know that they're important in your life. Affection doesn't mean groping. Groping is a selfish touch. This is, no, it's a gentle caress. It's a hug. It's a pat on the back. It's just letting them know that you're thinking about them. It's as leaving a sticky note on their toothbrush that says, I love your smile. Make it glow today. I don't know, just something like that. Just giving you some ideas. Number two, they want conversation. They want that relational connection. They want to ask. There's a great line from Seinfeld where Kramer's talking about why he doesn't want to get married. Because when you get married, you just sit in the same room and you talk. What do you talk about? You talk about your day. How was your day? How was your day? How was your day? And he freaks out because he can't do it. He knows that's one of women's top needs is just conversation. They want to connect. What's going on in your life? What's going on in your day? Sitting there a minimum of 15 minutes a day of just connecting. And the key here is there's no problem to solve. There's nothing judgmental about this. There's nothing analyzed on this. It's just sharing of life. This is who I am. This is what I'm going through. Not, here's my problems, fix them. It's just, let's talk. Why does she love talking to her mom so much? Because she's not able to talk to you sometimes. It's just simply she wants to be able to connect, and maybe she's filling that need somewhere else, but you're in her life, and you should be a primary person to meet this need. It shouldn't be something that's primarily met outside the relationship. And some of you guys look at this, well, that's going to cost me something. Yeah. Phone is down. Rebecca, it's weird. Women have this thing. She knows when I'm on my phone while I'm talking to her on the phone. That's the great thing about a smartphone. You're going to sit there and be talking, I don't know what it is. There's a certain number of uh-huhs without any sort of active listening response where she all of a sudden just knows. And I think I'm on FaceTime, but I'm not. And she just says, I'll talk to you when you're ready to talk. Click. I'm like, she hung up on me. And whenever I remember one time a challenge was like, would you hang up on me? She goes, you had already hung up on me mentally. How do you get back at that one, right? It's true. All right, moving on. Honesty and openness. She wants to be able to share her life with you and wants you to be able to share your life with her. They want you to create an open circle of trust that's just between the two of you where you have honest, clear communication. Number four is security, to provide a sense of security, financial security, that you would take on the lion's share of the burden of providing for basic necessities. Now, I know there's everybody's got every different arrangement for this. Sometimes, you know, you've got situations where women make more than men. That's not the issue. At the end of the day is that you're going to be able to take care of the home. And you might have an arrangement where she says, well, I'm going to work and I'm going to do this while you stay home with the kids. Whatever your arrangement is, at the end of the day, she wants to know that you are willing to provide and take care of the home, that you're not just going to sit in the room and play video games all day and look for a second mama. Was that too close to home? I don't know. And then lastly, family commitment. So you want somebody who's committed to the family, that there is an engagement with the children, that they're able to talk about discipline, that we talk about our schedules, that you aren't an absentee father, that even though you may be committed to work for the sake of the family, it's committed to work for the sake of the family, not committed to work because that now becomes the object of your affection somewhere outside of the home, that the children and that the family and the family unit, that you're actively planning things, that, you know, in other words, let me ask you guys this question. When was the last time you scheduled the babysitter? Okay, it got a little silent. I remember after Melissa passed away, I had to start doing that on my dates. And I realized, wow, it's not actually that easy. I used to think that simply because I said, hey, let's go out this Friday night, check. And what did I just say? Honey, get all the household chores done, rearrange your whole Friday afternoon schedule, go through the hassle of calling 16 teenage girls to see which one's going to be available to watch the kids, and then I'm going to show up 10 minutes before it's time to go out, have no plan, no reservations whatsoever, and get in the car and think I'm magnanimously just going to say, where do you want to go, hon?
That's not what she was looking for on the family commitment side.
Before I get to the men, there's a funny story I read this past week, which I just, hopefully it's not too inappropriate. I'll read it the first service, and if it's out of line, you just tell me. I won't read it the second service. It says, I heard about this store in New York called the Husband Store. Hey, some of you single ladies are like, tell me more. Where is this? I'm ready to go to New York. On the first floor, it explains that on each floor above, there'll be different types of husbands for sale. The higher up you go, the better they are, and the more expensive they are. So she goes up to the first floor, and there's a bunch of men standing around with a big sign that says, these men have jobs. She says, you know, that's pretty good. But she's curious to see what's on the next floor. I mean, hey, it only gets better from here, right? So she goes to the next floor, and on the second floor is a sign that says, these men have jobs, and they're really good with kids. Not bad, wow. So she goes up another floor. These men have jobs, they love kids, and they're really cute. She's like, fantastic. So she goes up to the next floor, and it says, these men have jobs, they love kids, they're good looking, and they help out around the house. She's like, dang. So she goes up to the next floor. Says, you are a visitor 3,248,618. This floor is simply here to prove that no matter how great a guy is, women are never satisfied. Across the street, there's another store called the Wife Store. The first floor sign says the same thing. So a man goes up to the first floor and it says, these women love to have sex. No man's ever made it past that floor. And that's because number one on every man's list is sex. That's number one on every man's list is sex. Most studies say that if it's happening less than 6 times a month in your relationship, then there's probably a problem there. Less than 6 times a month says it's probably an issue, whether it's been talked about or not. Second thing is relational companionship. The second thing is relational companionship. He wants you to go fishing with him. He wants you to watch the ball game with him. And now listen, here's the thing. It's up to the both of you. I mentioned this last or 2 weeks ago. Couples that play together, stay together. Why? Because on the guy's list, it's number two up there. In the same way that couples that don't communicate, their relationship's going to fall apart. If you don't connect, you're disconnected and it's going to fall apart. These are major needs in a relationship. So I'm not saying you got to go out and love fishing and watch football, but you have to find something the two of you love to do, whether it's ballroom dancing or hiking or just going for a walk around the neighborhood. You need to find something you can do. And guys, you need to realize she's not your wrestling partner. She's not your sparring partner. If you love to do jiu-jitsu, don't practice the move on her, okay? Find something you both love to do. Number three, attractive. Look for somebody who's attractive. I'll just say it this way. There's a time and place for sweatpants. And there's a time and place for full glam, okay? There's a time and place just to hang out around the house, and there's a time and place where he wants to see all you got, baby. Just every so often remind me of that. It's just because I love when you do it all up for me and show me that I'm special and that you want to look your best for me. Guys, list is such, it's so awful saying some of these things. Next one is he wants domestic support. He's looking for a maid, okay? He's top needs. He is looking for domestic support. And number five is respect and admiration. There's one survey done by Emerson Edrich which says, when given the choice between being unloved and left alone in the world, or being thought of as inadequate and disrespected, 74% of men say they'd rather be unloved and left alone in the world than thought of as inadequate. Women said the exact opposite. When you think about where their needs are in that sense, one wants to be loved, one wants to be respected. And great summary, it says, women need to hear, have I told you lately how much I love you? Men need to hear, have I told you lately how many people I've told about how awesome I think you are? And just shows the difference in what each one is looking for.
So you may look at that list, and your first thought may be thinking about the other person's list and saying, that list is shallow and dumb. But each of you should look not to your own interest, but consider the other person's interest and needs as more important than yours. What would happen in your relationships if you took the time to figure out what their needs are? That's a general list, and that may not be true for your relationship. That may not be true for you. What would happen if you took the time to figure out what are your top five needs and you made them the highest priority in your life, in your relationship? Yeah, it's going to take some work. But love works if you do. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the opportunity we have to look at your word and have a laugh and have some fun. But at the same time, allow it to become a mirror that pierces into our soul. Father, each of us need to confess that we have not been very good at meeting needs. Rather, we've been extremely good at complaining about, focused on our own needs. Father, may we just come before you and lay our selfishness down. And accept, Lord, that if you had been as selfish as I was, you never would have gone to the cross. Brother, we need to look to you, to your example. Understand, we're swimming in grace. And none of us deserve to be loved by you or by anybody else. Because it takes a lot of grace to cover up all of our sins. So, Father, may we just look at our relationship with a different view. As one who's been saved, one who's living for eternity, and one who is a reflection of the way that Christ has loved us. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.